Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, World Press Freedom Day. Two EU member states slip down the World Press Freedom Index. Turkey, the world's biggest jailer of journalists. Also, 50 years of social upheaval in France and how the 1968 movement was different to today's protests.
May 68
was a much more collective and general movement, with a much more radical agenda to change politics and government. Today, that's not the case.
And the glam and the grumbles at NATO's new HQ. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Turkey's failed coup in 2016 led to a crackdown by the country's president. Analysts say Recep Tayyip Erdogan's swift response has sapped Turkey's democratic institutions of their strength and hollowed out the country's independent media. During the week, the world took part in a global day of action for the Free Turkey Media campaign run by Amnesty International, among others. I'm joined by Amnesty's media manager for Europe and Turkey, Stefan Simanovic. Hello, Stefan.
Hello there.
Now, journalists have been handed life sentences for allegedly aiding plotters of the coup. 50,000 have been imprisoned, including dozens of writers and journalists. Amnesty talks about Turkey becoming the world's biggest jailer of journalists.
Not just that, but over 180 media outlets have been shut down, and there's been a chilling effect for journalists who have been hounded, who've been detained, who've been harassed, intimidated, and arrested. Some have been sentenced now. The Altans were given life sentences for supposedly supporting terrorism charges on trumped-up charges, which clearly have no basis.
And one of those Altan brothers, he was accused of sending subliminal messages the day before the coup attempt in Turkey.
Well, for that and other things, I mean, that shows the ridiculousness of some of the charges here. He was on a television talk show and talked about something, and he was accused later of sending out subliminal messages. But if you strip down all the charges, there's absolutely no substance. People are being tried and sentenced without any evidence, and it's also a travesty of justice. It's not just these people who are being put in the dock. It's actually Turkish justice that's being put in the dock here. It's something that the Turkish authorities will not be proud of as well when they meet with other governments and when this is exposed and this is talked about. And it's important. I know there's a lot going on in the world because World Press Freedom Day is a day for journalists all over the world to mark the importance of press freedom, and there are countries we must not lose sight of the fact what's happening in Turkey for almost 2 years now has been a deliberate attempt to undermine civil society. It's a crackdown which has left no area of civil society untouched by the state of emergency, and it's resulted in a devastation of a landscape which was once quite vibrant. So the situation for journalists in Turkey is a dire one, and it's one which the world can't sit by and allow to continue as it's doing. Without evidence, journalists and other human rights defenders, writers, a huge swathe of Turkish society have been targeted and jailed, and they're under constant threat of arbitrary detention, prosecution, conviction for nothing more than doing their jobs or expressing peaceful opinions. To use this as a pretext to crack down on free expression and to round up and lock up journalists for long periods and to create a state of fear as well, which is what's happening in Turkey, is completely unacceptable.
Tell me about the Free Turkey Media campaign.
What we're doing actually with the Free Turkey Media campaign, which is led by Amnesty, but with a whole bunch of free expression organisations, Reporters Without Borders, Index and Censorship, Human Rights Watch, Article 19, etc. We're basically trying to do a similar thing to the Free AJ Staff campaign. I think you might remember back in 2013 when three journalists were jailed in Egypt. There was a global campaign by journalists and others to say, let these people go. They were also charged with, on trumped up terrorism charges, but because there was global pressure from journalists themselves, from the public, and from governments, because it's very important for governments to push hard, to use all the leverage they can to ensure that they protect press freedom, because without press freedom, then democracy is damaged. It's a tear in the social fabric. Journalists who are imprisoned for no reason are living in these very drastic conditions and facing potential life sentences as well, which is obviously will cause a chilling effect. People are scared what they write. People are scared what they say. People are scared even of what they tweet. So this is a reality for not just for journalists, but for everyone in Turkey who wants to speak out, because the shutting down of civil society organizations has created a completely suffocating climate of fear in the country.
Stefan Simanovits from Amnesty International, thanks a lot for being with us on Inside Europe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Europe. Each year, the international organization Reporters Without Borders releases its World Press Freedom Index, ranking freedom for journalists to do their job in 180 countries around the world. There were no changes at the top, Norway, or the bottom, North Korea, but several significant tumbles, including for the Czech Republic and Slovakia, who both slipped 10 places down the chart. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
Tibor Gašpar, head of the Slovak police force, announcing the murder of journalist Jan Kuciak, shot dead with his fiancée Martina Kušnirova in late February in what police believe was a professional killing. Kuciak's murder, which came as he delved into links between the Calabrian mafia and Slovak politicians, sent shockwaves through the country and brought down the Prime Minister, the Interior Minister, and Mr. Gašpar himself. And it's also affected Slovakia's rankings in this year's World Press Freedom Index, falling 10 places to 27th. Reporters Without Borders said former Prime Minister Robert Fico's labelling of journalists as filthy anti-Slovak prostitutes and idiotic hyenas also had an effect.
Of course it's worrying, because it's not good that we are losing the position.
Matuš Kostolny, editor-in-chief of the leading independent newspaper Denik N.
But we have to keep in mind that there is a one really dramatic thing which happened in Slovakia 2 months ago, and that changed completely the situation in the media landscape in Slovakia. Then everything else looks more serious and more dramatic than it used before. So yes, this is the reason why we lost the position. And then people started to take seriously also the politicians influencing the media here in Slovakia. And that's the case in Slovakia for years and years, but we were able to pretend that everything is more okay than it is in the end.
So Jan Kuciak's murder, he says, has on one hand slightly skewed the rankings, but also simultaneously drawn attention to the problem areas in Slovakia's media landscape. Most notably, the increasing role of oligarchs in controlling Slovakia's private media. In fact, Matuš Kostolny co-founded Denik N after leaving his previous employer, the respected broadsheet SME, when it was bought by the controversial investment group Penta. And there's also rising government pressure on public media, in particular some contentious personnel changes at Slovak television.
Prosím pěkně, toto je samopal.
Across the border in the Czech Republic, there are also concerns at political pressure on reporters. Here's the president, Miloš Zeman, holding up a gift he received when visiting the Plzeň region, a model Kalashnikov with the words "for journalists" embellished on the side. And here he is joking with Vladimir Putin, of all people, that there were too many journalists and they needed to be liquidated. On the Reporters Without Borders index, the Czech Republic has slipped 11 places to 34, and this in a nation where the two leading broadsheets are owned by a consortium belonging to the Prime Minister, who is also the country's second richest man. That said, both the Czech Republic and Slovakia are still regarded by the index as fairly good in terms of press freedom, quite different to Poland and Hungary, which are seen as problematic. Jeremy Drucker, executive director and editor-in-chief of Transitions, a non-profit organisation established to strengthen the news media in post-communist countries of Europe and the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think in most of the foreign coverage of the region, there's too much generalization. So the situation, I think, is dramatically different, obviously, in Hungary, just in the diversity of coverage and outlets you get there and the pressure on journalists and the media in general, not just overtly, but a lot of the hidden ways through, well, subsidies given to friendly media and government advertising. And obviously, I think we all know the government leans on companies that dare to advertise in the independent media. They're probably too afraid to do that. There's a bit of that in Poland as well. And clearly the government's takeover of the public media there resembles what was done in Hungary, but we're still far away from that kind of situation in the Czech Republic. I think Slovakia is moving more in that direction, but I think the Czech Republic is still not there and still has a public media system that people throughout Central Europe and more broadly Eastern Europe could only envy.
And while Europe is still the safest place for journalists to do their job, there is clearly growing animosity towards them here. And Reporters Without Borders seem especially concerned about politicians openly encouraging that hostility and hate. Whether it's waving Kalashnikovs around or issuing dark threats, reporters are increasingly under fire, sometimes literally. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. As France marks the half-century anniversary of May 1968, a profound period of social upheaval, protesters are back on the streets, venting their anger against reforms being pushed through by the year-old centrist government of President Emmanuel Macron. But the spirit of today's movement is very different from the watershed year that left an indelible mark on French politics and society, as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
This week's traditional May Day protests kicked off what many expect will be a month of unrest by angry workers and French students, recalling another tumultuous time 50 years ago.
Boulevard Saint-Germain, les pavés de l'émeute volent.
May 1968 started with student demands for more freedoms. It spread to factories with millions of workers claiming better salaries and jobs. But it was also about bigger issues.
May 68, at the beginning, at the heart, was a revolt against authority, very frozen social hierarchies. And it was all about youth, teenagers, finding a place and asking for more personal freedom.
Historian and political analyst Nicole Bacharon.
You know, it was sexual freedom, it was political freedom, it was political rights, it was all about music, it was about creativity in the young world, away from parental authority. That freedom is now taken for granted.
Some believe it was more about chaos than anything else. Publisher Jean Picolec was a young editor in May 1968. He walked past the protests at the Sorbonne University campus every day on his way to work, but he never joined them.
I was totally against them. The intellectual atmosphere was dangerous.
Picolet denounces the leftist intellectuals of that era who supported communist movements overseas that were violent and repressive. And he mocks expressions crafted in May 68, like it's forbidden to forbid, that remain in French lexicon today.
By saying it was forbidden to forbid, everyone did everything, and things got out of control. They burnt people's cars. It was destroying just to destroy.
Capitaliste, représenté par le système de Gaulle, nous nous en foutons.
May 68 also fit into a broader context of revolt. Students were marching in the streets of former West Germany and Italy. Americans were protesting against Vietnam and for civil rights. In France, nearly a million people marched in Paris, demanding that the country's aging president and wartime leader, Charles de Gaulle, resign. His party went on to win legislative elections the following month, but a year later, de Gaulle stepped down after losing a referendum. Today, workers are back on the streets. Rail employees are holding rolling strikes against government efforts to overhaul the aging state-owned SNCF railway. And at schools like Nanterre University outside Paris, where the May 68 movement started, students are again barricading buildings and covering walls with graffiti, protesting planned changes to the admission system. Manel Jadoun, who heads Nanterre University's Communist Student Union, says some things are similar to May 68.
We are asking for freedom and more rights for everyone and better quality education. The context is different. We're not in a situation of general strike across France. We hope the situation will change and become even bigger than May 68.
Broader grievances against Macron's reforms were also on display this week. Health workers, teachers, immigrant rights activists, and anti-capitalists were on the streets. But 69-year-old former Trotskyist Alain Buchana, who joined the protests, says there is something missing in May 2018.
May 68 was a much more collective and general movement, with a much more radical agenda to change politics and government. Today, that's not the case.
Historian Bacharon agrees.
Now, when you see protests in France, it's not about freedom. It's not about changing the world. It's all about security and protection.
May 68 ended one era. France's current president, Emmanuel Macron, is part of the new one. He was not even born until a decade after the uprising. Still, he can expect one continuity, more protests and strikes in the weeks and months to come. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
You're listening to Inside Europe. NATO's new headquarters are finally open for business after 7 years of construction. Yes, 7 years of construction. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels on the glam and the grumbling and how officials are finding themselves nostalgic for the rich history of the time-worn barracks that have housed the alliance since 1967.
Some officials had tears in their eyes as NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg delivered an emotional goodbye last week to the complex that's housed the alliance since French President Charles de Gaulle kicked NATO out of its Paris headquarters as he downgraded French participation in 1966. As the 29 foreign ministers gathered around the table for the last time Friday, Stoltenberg recalled some of the most memorable events that council room had seen.
After the Berlin Wall came down, Chancellor Helmut Kohl drove from Bonn to address the ambassadors here, to reassure them that the reunification of his country would mean not a German Europe, but a European Germany. There was the meeting in 1994 when Secretary General Manfred Werner, sick from cancer and attached to a hospital drip, chaired the council in order to oversee the decision to use force to help protect UN peacekeepers and expand the no-fly zone in former Yugoslavia.
The only time NATO has ever invoked its founding principle of Article 5, mutual defense, was also there after September 11, 2001. The Belgian military barracks were only supposed to be temporary, but ended up being the alliance's home for 5 decades, during which time membership almost doubled from 15 to 29 countries, making it a tight squeeze. The massive new glass and steel complex, which is just across the street, is 2.7 million square feet, the size of 10 football fields. Shaped to look like interlocking fingers to symbolize unity, it took more than 7 years and more than $2 billion to complete. Last year's meeting of NATO leaders offered a sneak peek as a memorial to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the 9/11 attacks was unveiled, dedicated by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and U.S. President Donald Trump, who seemed to approve in unscripted remarks.
It is truly fitting that these two artifacts now reside here so close together at the new NATO headquarters. And I never asked once what the new NATO headquarters cost. I refuse to do that. But it is beautiful.
By the next leaders' meeting, the July 11th summit, the transition has to be finished.
You want to move this one too? It's too old.
Go for a new one.
By May 1st, about half the 4,200 people working at NATO had moved, including Secretary General Stoltenberg's private office. That still leaves plenty to do in the next 2 months, Acting Deputy Spokesman Dylan White explains.
So right now we're in a period called dual operations, which is complicated in that we have to be running two headquarters at the same time. So we have to be running basically the full set of services for 2,000 people on one side of the street and the full set of services of 2,000 people on this side of the street. So it's complicated for all of our people in HR, in executive management, the people who run the buildings, but they're getting it done.
Leaving behind the once prevalent sentiment that partner nations, including Finland, Sweden, Georgia, and Ukraine, should work as closely as possible physically to allies' offices, they have not been granted space in the new building and are instead moving to the premises vacated by NATO's communications agency. The Russian mission will be there too. But despite all the upgrades, the new building isn't getting uniformly high marks for functionality. The long transition period apparently wasn't enough to pre-plan for sufficient information technology capabilities. One IT expert said privately that if the summit were held today, NATO would have to choose between its own communications operability and that of journalists covering the event. There are rampant complaints about the small size and big price hike in the cafeteria. Additionally, some employees may not be looking forward to the adjustment in their commutes. White says employees have been told they'll likely be walking more than 3 miles per day just to complete their normal tasks inside the huge facility.
So what we've been told is, you're going to be so healthy, everyone's going to be fit. So getting ready for that, getting some comfortable shoes.
Terry Schultz, DW, NATO headquarters.
If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Here's our email address, europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, Italy opens its first museum of fascism, while in Tuscany they're in the middle of a month commemorating Napoleon.
È molto amato perché effettivamente Napoleone è stato qui dal maggio.
He's very loved. He didn't only build his residences, but roads, bridges, a theatre, and he revolutionized society here. He left us a wonderful legacy, otherwise we wouldn't be here celebrating him.
And we look at the perks and privileges drivers in Norway get for buying electric cars. Stay tuned for these stories and more. The European Commission unveiled its proposal during the week for the next long-term EU budget. One of the proposals will probably upset Hungary and Poland, which have clashed with the EU over their alleged democratic backsliding. The Commission wants to cut off EU funds to member countries that do not respect the rule of law. I'm joined by Ryan Heath, political editor at Politico Europe and host of the podcast EU Confidential. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Keith.
EU member states Poland and Hungary, they've both come under fire for alleged rule of law breaches. Tell us more.
Well, it's been an ongoing battle for the EU for around about 5 years now when we're considering the case of Hungary. And more recently, Poland has been the cause of concern. But it's not only those countries. It's also Slovakia. We've seen concerns in Malta and in Romania as well. Various colors of government, not just conservative governments like we see in Hungary and Poland. And what the EU is worried about is that those countries are really putting together a bunch of changes that individually on their own don't undermine any individual institution, but together really put into question how serious democratic checks and balances are in those countries. And those are also countries that have benefited greatly from EU funds. So these are countries that are really the net beneficiaries of the EU budget. And so being unable to have any influence by merely doing court cases, by having dialogues and so on, the EU is using one of its last bits of ammunition that it has left, really, which is to say, we're not going to give you all of the funds that you were expecting unless you really engage with us more on these rule of law questions. It doesn't mean they're going to cut off funding entirely, but it does mean that they want to send a very strong signal that we're watching and we're going to put conditions on this money from now on.
What kind of thing are the EU trying to fight back against?
Well, I think the EU is really saying that its core values revolve around having an independent judiciary. It revolves around having a vibrant media sector that doesn't come under pressure from any one owner or any one political faction. And they're not getting a lot of traction with very belligerent leaders like Viktor Orban or Mr. Kaczynski, who is the force behind the throne in Poland, as it were. And so what they're really trying to say is that if you want to be part of our community, you have to take the frustrating parts as well as the nice parts, as well as the trinkets, as well as the money.
So now it's time to... Is punish too strong a word to punish these countries?
Well, this morning we described it as declaring budget war on illiberal democracy. So I don't think it's too strong to call it punishment. But there is one important thing that your listeners do need to understand, which is that when the European Commission makes this proposal, it's just the first bid in a two-year-long negotiation. So just because the Commission has made this proposal, it doesn't mean that it's actually going to get out at the end of this system. And the Commission's tried to be very clever about this. They've actually made it as a separate proposal alongside the financial proposal of the budget. So they are trying to separate it out. You could get the budget going forward and you could have this set of conditions stopped. Those two things could happen at the same time. And also they've tried to be very clever because they know that the budget requires consensus. And they know that either Poland or Hungary could simply veto this idea if it was really embedded into the budget. So they've tried to make it a separate set of proposals that would require only a majority vote amongst the national governments. So they're really sort of weaving as carefully and cleverly as they can through the system to try and hit at Poland and Hungary. But Poland and Hungary may win in the end.
When is that vote likely to take place?
Well, the one around the conditionality, we can expect that in 2018. But the one about the overall 1.3 trillion euro budget, that will definitely not happen until next year. And it could happen as late as 2020.
And how likely are other EU member states to give Brussels unprecedented new powers to financially punish members or sanction members, if you like?
I would say it's unlikely at this stage. What national governments tend to do, even if they would agree with the Commission on an individual issue, is they guard their own powers very carefully. They don't want to give this permission to the Commission, thinking it will be used against Poland and Hungary, only to have it used against them a couple of years down the line on a different matter. So the national governments are always the conservative force in this process.
What are we going to see? What's the next step?
Well, the next step is we'll have to see some reactions from Central and Eastern Europe. And how hard they push back will determine a little bit how much capital the Commission is willing to spend on this matter. So we need to have a little bit more dialogue. The Commission says that it believes in dialogue, so it's definitely not going to try and shut that down. It's going to let this percolate through the system, and then you'll see it come up at national leaders' summits towards the end of this year.
Ryan Heath, political editor at Politico Europe and host of the podcast EU Confidential. Thanks for joining us on Inside Europe.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Europe. Italy is struggling to form a new government after inconclusive elections in early March, but what the results did clarify is that the right is on the rise, winning almost 20% of the vote. Since the elections, support for the right wing has only risen, and that has one particular tiny town in northern Italy worried and more determined than ever to go ahead with plans to open Italy's first Museum of Fascism. Megan Williams has this report from Predappio.
A door unlocks, and the abandoned past a town would like to forget but can't opens before us. The grand entrance to the once glorified headquarters of Italy's fascist movement.
Ooh.
Now strewn with dead pigeons trapped inside. We're in the enormous curved edifice that, when built in 1937, had the now bizarre-sounding name, the Palace of Fascism and Hospitality. It once welcomed thousands flocking here to the town of Predappio and the birthplace of fascist leader Benito Mussolini.
Questo è vuoto da decenni.
Cultural consultant Carlo Giunchi is part of the initiative in Predappio to turn the empty building into the Museum of Fascism, not to celebrate the regime that murdered thousands, but to educate Italians about it in a moment when many fear extremism is on the rise again. As we move through the vast stone corridors and offices, strewn with broken glass and debris, Giunchi explains that since the fall of Mussolini in 1945, the fascist palace has remained largely unused in this small town of 6,000. Ironically, Predappio's local governments have been left-leaning, communist, socialist, and democrats for more than a century.
All right, so we're going up.
On the top floor, we reach a tower. Giunchi explains all the fascist-era community centers had a tower. It had no practical use, he tells me, but is a symbol of masculine power. But Giunchi is one of many cultural experts who also see the beauty in the sleek, oversized architecture of the fascist era. He doesn't want to destroy the palace, but instead wants to do what Germans have done with their Nazi architectural past, use the spaces that once housed the murderous regimes to educate. Hence the plans to open a museum here in several years. But the plan isn't just about the building. It's also about small shops just down the street from the empty palace that sell fascist and Nazi paraphernalia. Inside one, the woman at the cash phones the store owner after I introduce myself as a journalist, no doubt wary of the attention.
C'è un giornalista che... Ah, okay.
She tells me the shop owner doesn't want to be interviewed, but welcomes me to peruse the Mussolini statues, portraits, T-shirts, and even wine.
Pesante turismo filofascista e adesso anche filonazista.
Guido Guarini is a councillor in the nearby town of San Sepolcro, where during the fascist period, several small concentration camps held Yugoslavian prisoners. He says the stores upset him. He's come here with his Russian girlfriend, who's heard about the shops on Russian television. He says all the coverage of them has created what he calls neo-fascist and neo-Nazi tourism.
Cioè, non è questo il problema. Il problema è il cercare di fare business oggi con...
Guarini says he has no problem with people visiting Mussolini's home or gravesite, but he does have a problem with the sale of freshly manufactured fascist trinkets. Outside, Mayor Giorgio Frassinetto shakes his head.
Quello è stato il crollo.
Opening these stores, he tells me, was one of the biggest mistakes the town ever made. He says the previous mayor decided to allow them to open in the early 1990s, afraid that if he didn't, the sale of the items and fascist groups themselves would go deeper underground. But what happened was, when the stores opened, they began attracting fascist supporters who now show up to march through the town's streets on Mussolini's birthday, the day he died, and the anniversary of his infamous victory march on Rome. Frassinetto says the videos of those supporters on YouTube have only drawn more people each year to the marches.
Siamo stanchi.
We're tired of this, the mayor tells me. But despite the fatigue of having attracted a movement the town wants nothing to do with, Frassinetto and town members are working hard to find the funding and finish the plans to attract a new kind of pilgrim. School groups, history buffs, those wanting to learn more about this dark period in Italian history.
Perché quando uno visiterà il centro studi, penso che non avrà nessuna voglia di andarsi a comprare un accendino con la testa di Mussolini.
Because once people visit a museum that tells the whole story of fascism, he says, they might not be so inclined to buy a bust of Mussolini down the street. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Predappio.
And we'll have more from Italy in about 10 minutes. And in just a moment, why car buyers in Norway are choosing electric vehicles.
So the rich people in Oslo now, they have electric cars for downtown, driving to the toll roads for free. And they have a SUV for driving to the cottage.
And 4x4.
Yeah, and the poor people, they can't afford it.
I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Last year, for the first time, over half the new cars sold in Norway were electric. Other countries have made bold statements about phasing out petrol and diesel cars, but Norway is really on course for fulfilling its promise to stop sales of diesel and petrol or gas cars by 2025. How is it managing to do this? Government perks and privileges that you would not believe. This report from John Lawrenson in Oslo.
Driving out of Oslo in the evening rush hour with electric car owner Jürgen Gilberg.
What do you like about driving one of these electric cars then?
No, it's quiet and...
Yeah. You can hear or not hear.
Yeah, and it's
how quiet it is.
Superb acceleration.
Oh! That was probably almost illegal. But it's true because you've got no gear changes, so
no.
You put your foot down and it goes basically.
Yeah, it has instant torque.
Instant torque.
Yeah.
All right.
Jürgen and his family are very into his big all-electric, all-American Tesla. They even called their cat Tesla. It cost 95,000 euros, the car, not the cat. But everything's more expensive in Norway. And, says Jürgen, because you don't have to pay tax on electric vehicles, or EVs as people usually call them here, it was about the same price as, say, an all-options Volkswagen Passat. And when it comes to perks for going electric, that's just the start of it.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, we can see the traffic is almost on a standstill, and I can...
You are swishing down the bus lane.
Yeah, this is totally illegal for EV cars.
It feels a bit naughty, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah, it does. We do not have any toll charges, and I drive 50,000 kilometers a year, so I couldn't afford not having a Tesla in Norway. Compared to a gasoline car, it's one-fifth of the expenses.
We've overtaken about 500 cars since we started this little conversation.
Yeah.
How do people know that they're really electric cars driving down the bus lane? Well, you get to recognise the popular ones, like the Nissan Leaf and the e-Golf, but also because in Norway, the number plates of all electric vehicles start with the letter E. Using the free smartphone app supplied by Oslo City Council, an EV driver opens a gate and glides quietly into a tunnel that leads down beneath the thousand-year-old fortress that looms over the ICC in the centre of Oslo. With me is Ståle Portvik, head of electric mobility at Oslo City Hall.
It's actually, I think, the first parking garage for EVs only in the world. So we are building more of this and also more mobility houses.
How much does this one cost then to park your car and to charge it up?
Well, that's the brilliant thing. It's free of charge. So you are parking for free, you have free electricity, so it's a very strong incentive.
Right in the middle of the city?
Yeah, that's correct. And at the same time, we are actually removing parking for traditional cars, ICTs, combustion engines. So what we want to do is actually to boost the shift in the driveline of the car, because we think that technology can actually help us to reduce emissions. Remember, 61% of all emissions in the city are actually coming from transport. So if you are going to reduce the emission, you have to do something about the traffic.
And doing something about the traffic, Oslo City Council certainly has been. A demonstration last November when 4,000 people, alerted on Facebook, gathered to protest against a 74% increase to the charge for crossing the toll ring around Oslo. The city council had just started removing 20,000 free street parking spaces, which EVs can still use for free, when it pushed through the hike. Now, if you have a diesel car, say, you have to pay over 6 euros when you drive into Oslo and, get this, another 6 to drive out again. On high pollution days, the charge is multiplied by 3.
So, how is the weather in Norway? I need
the
to
weather
a
is
can
very snowy as I'm climbing into your car. Yes.
You have to do that.
Do you want the microphone in there?
I track down the demonstration organiser, who's busy planning another demo, and go to interview her, sheltered from the snow, in her petrol-powered, obviously, Mini.
My name is Cecilia Lyngby, and I started this Facebook group May 2017 because I read all about how this will be, the cost for the families, the single parents, the sick people, the older people, and I was, like, quite angry, and all the electric cars, they're driving through for free, and they are parking for free. It's like people with the gas cars, we are like the bad guys.
But well, the Oslo City Council says, well, yes, because, you know, you're more polluting than the electric vehicle guys.
But we don't agree with that, because not everybody can do that. If you live in an apartment block, you don't have the opportunity to charge your car. If you live in a house, you can charge your car every time you are at home. So the rich people in Oslo now, they have electric cars for downtown, driving to the toll roads for free, and they have a SUV for driving to the cottage.
And 4x4.
Yeah, and the poor people, they can't afford it.
I make my way back to the centre of town and find myself walking alongside a raging torrent of a stream rushing down to the sea. You can fish salmon out of this stream, apparently. Electric cars are only as clean as the energy used to generate the electricity they run off. So in France, EVs basically run on nuclear power. In Germany, it's coal. In the UK, a mix of gas, coal and nuclear. But in Norway, their abundant and cheap electricity is all hyper-clean hydro. Their EVs run on water. Their economy, though, runs on oil. Most countries have debts. Norway has a savings account with $1 trillion in it. It's Qatar with reindeer. So when I go to see the Secretary General of the 50,000-strong Norwegian Electric Car Owners Association, Christiane Bu, I ask her what she answers when unpleasant people say that Norway can only afford to go electric because it sold so much polluting oil to other countries.
I agree to a certain extent. But at the same time, we need to stop using oil. And we need to stop doing that as fast as possible. Norway is showing the world it does work. What really matters is that Norway inspires others to follow. We're telling the car industry, the customers do want this technology. As soon as they can compete when it comes to price, people are ready. And the fact is that right now we have a situation where there are long waiting lists for new models. Used electric vehicles are sold immediately. So the biggest barrier for higher sales right now is that there are not enough cars on offer, especially cars with longer range and also in the bigger car segments.
Back with the EV owner Jürgen Gilberg, we've arrived at his home out in the suburb where the snows are metered deep. After a quick inspection of the car chargers in his garage, his wife, Pernille, drives up with their two daughters. It's become common for Norwegian families to choose an EV as their second car. The Gilbergs are a two electric car family, hers a little electric BMW. John Lawrenson, DW, Oslo.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. One of Italy's biggest islands, just off the west coast, is Elba, part of the Tuscany region. It's about an hour from the mainland by ferry, and that's the island Napoleon chose when he was forced to abdicate as emperor and go into exile, possibly because he was able to see his native Corsica just across the water. He arrived in May 1814, and even though he stayed there for less than a year, the people of Elba remember him with great fondness. And a month packed with commemorative events is underway. Danny Mitzman sent us this postcard from the island.
Waves lapping on the beach at Portoferraio, a sound Napoleon Bonaparte would have become familiar with during his 10 months on Elba. With its breathtaking sea and landscapes, mild climate and lush, fragrant flora, it's easy to understand why Napoleon chose this specific island for his exile. Gloria Pereira is the director of Elba's historical archives. It's her day off and she's on her way out fishing in her dinghy, but she's taken time for a brief chat with me in the gardens of the Palazzina dei Mulini, Napoleon's official residence on Elba.
When he arrived, he wrote proclamations promising citizens that his rule there would have brought wealth and visitors to the island. In fact, he brought many visitors to Elba, especially the English, who were curious to see the monster depicted in their satirical cartoons in the flesh.
According to Gloria, Napoleon was very well received by the Albans.
He was seen as a paternal and popular legislator. He finished construction projects that had already been started And during his time as a sovereign here, he lived in contact with the people, often going out on his horse or in his carriage, and stopping to interact with the locals.
Today, the people of Elba dedicate the entire month of May to Napoleon. There are concerts, readings, and a church mass held on May the 5th to mark the anniversary of his death in 1821. This year, there's also the opening of a multimedia exhibition about Napoleon's stay here. Yet for a long time, he was largely forgotten. In fact, it wasn't until the bicentenary 4 years ago that locals started to take an interest in their Napoleonic past again. Before leaving me for her fishing rod, Gloria explains why. When Napoleon left, French rule ended and the Tuscans took back control.
Il Granducato di Toscana sicuramente ha operato una specie di...
The Grand Duchy of Tuscany certainly operated a policy of discrediting Napoleon and the French era to make Albans forget their French past. It did everything it could to dismantle what Napoleon had created. We had obtained a lot of privileges, such as the social privilege of divorce, as the Napoleonic Code and all its laws had been adopted here. These were completely removed and substituted with all the laws of the Grand Duchy.
Quello che invece vediamo adesso è un mantello
che. Showing me around the inside of Napoleon's palace in Portoferraio is architect Leonello Balestrini.
Io sono dell'Elba, sono nato all'Elba, la mia famiglia.
I'm from Elba. I was born here and my family goes back generations. I'm a typical Elban, very attached to our island, which we call the Rock. As an architect, I also had the immense honor and pleasure of renovating the Teatro dei Vigilanti, which was Napoleon's theater. So I have a deep connection with Napoleon.
So much so that he set up a historical reenactment society for the bicentenary.
La nostra è una passione che ci porta a interpretare.
Ours is a passion that leads us to reenact and reconstruct stories as they really happened at the time. Every member of our association interprets an Elban person who really existed.
Dressed in a velvet tailcoat, riding boots, and a top hat and gloves, Leonello admits the costumes are a challenge in hot weather. But as he shows me through the house, describing costume balls they've organised and the events to come this month, his enthusiasm is contagious.
Interpreto in questa associazione il procuratore imperiale Vincenzo Vantini.
I interpret the role of the imperial magistrate Vincenzo Vantini, who was Napoleon's confidant. Our clothes have been made to look exactly like the originals, with the same designs, and our accessories are often from the period itself. So it really is a great passion.
As we finish our tour back in the gardens, overlooking the stunning bay below, Leonello's keen to remind me how important Napoleon's legacy is to modern-day Albans.
He's very loved. He was here from May 1814 to February 1815, so a very few months. But in those months, he managed to totally overhaul the political and economic situation of the island of Elba. He didn't only build his residences, but roads, bridges, a theatre, and he revolutionised society here. He left us a wonderful legacy, otherwise we wouldn't be here celebrating him.
As the tourists continue to stream into his villa, I wonder if the little emperor with the big hat would today get a kick out of all the attention more than 2 centuries after his departure. Perhaps, like Gloria, he'd prefer a quiet bit of fishing. Danny Mitzman, DW Radio, Elba.
And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Gert Georgi, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.